This is the Freedom Files, a Pursuit of Justice podcast focusing on a wide range of issues involving liberty and justice for people with disabilities, whether they are young adults or seniors or any age in between. Your host is attorney Thomas F. Coleman. Hello, I'm Tom Coleman, host of the Freedom Files, a Pursuit of Justice podcast. On the shelf behind me, you can see several books. One of them is called The Domino Effect. I wrote that in 2009, and it recalls my advocacy activities over the course of almost four decades. For today's podcast, we're going to kind of walk through the book, take a walk down memory lane, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of my specific advocacy activities so you will get to know a little bit more about me, who I am, and how my background informs this podcast and future series and so on. I think it's good for you to know a little bit more about me so you can understand the motivation and the content of the podcast series. I prepared some slides, so I'm going to do a screen share, and the slides will help guide us through the rest of this podcast. So, as I said, the focus of today's episode is the domino effect, my life as an advocate. We're going to take a look back at the issues, causes, and populations that formed the basis of my first four decades as a legal advocate, starting in 1972 as a young law student through 2009 when I published The Domino Effect. This episode and all future episodes have a feature story, a print version, that will provide you with greater detail. You can read the feature story for this and other episodes online, or you can go to the website for the podcast and download it for later reading. But before we dive into some of the advocacy tales from the past, let's start where it all began. My birth at Highland Park General Hospital in Detroit, Michigan. Baby boy Coleman was born on March 15, 1948. I had a typical suburban childhood in the 1950s. I lived in what we would refer to today as a nuclear family, with a breadwinner dad and a homemaker mother who had several children, and of course, we had a dog. I went to Catholic school for 12 years. In grade school, I was an altar boy and a choir boy. I became a newspaper delivery boy when I was 12 years old. And in my younger years, I was rather obedient and scholarly. I became a member of the National Honor Society. My high school years were a little rocky, I guess. I started to question authority and to challenge the rules. But since I got good grades, I was given some leeway by those who were in charge. I guess they decided to put up with some of my questioning ways because I was getting good grades. Things changed when I went to college. I moved into an apartment in Detroit, away from my parents, where I could begin to explore what it meant to be a young gay man in that era. I went to Monteith College, which was an experimental college on the campus of Wayne State University, where I attended small classes. We had a ratio of anywhere from 2 to 10 students per professor. And they were liberal professors at that, who stressed independent thinking and creative writing. In my third year of undergraduate school, I finally realized that I wanted to be a lawyer. I wanted to learn the law as a tool to pursue justice for myself and for others who were stigmatized or treated unjustly by society. I wasn't going into law to make money. I was going into law to make change. I transferred from Wayne State to Detroit College of Law where I studied and studied and studied. I applied myself so diligently that I was the top student academically in my first year class. And then I caught the California bug. I knew that my future was on the West Coast, Los Angeles in particular. In addition to sunny weather most of the year, it was also the place where political movements were born. I wanted to be a part of the culture of advocacy. So I transferred to Loyola Law School in Los Angeles, where I soon entered the realm of gay rights advocacy. Today, we would call it LGBT advocacy. Along with a few other law students from several Los Angeles area law schools, we formed the first Gay Law Students Association in the nation. One of our main goals was to push for decriminalization of private sexual conduct between consenting adults. Even though we were otherwise law-abiding citizens, the law considered us to be felons because of our sexual conduct. Psychiatry considered us to be mentally ill. Religion labeled us as sinners. I called it the triple whammy: sick, sinful, criminal. I became Loyola's representative to the Law Student Division of the American Bar Association. We lobbied the ABA to go on record in favor of decriminalization of consenting adult sex in private. In 1973, the ABA adopted that position. In 1975, the California legislature finally removed the criminal stigma from our lives. Chapter one of The Domino Effect tells the story of the trials and tribulations we faced as openly gay law students living in a society that despised homosexuals. Chapter two recounts my advocacy activities from 1974 to 1979 as I challenged police harassment and entrapment of gay men for consenting adult sex, or even just for asking for consent, which the law considered to be criminal solicitation. After several years of litigation in a variety of criminal cases, I finally got a case before the California Supreme Court. The justices noted how the so-called lewd conduct law was enforced in a discriminatory manner against gay men, and the court declared the intentionally vague law to be unconstitutional. They imposed new legal standards that made it nearly impossible for the vice cops to continue with their discriminatory practices. From then forward, thousands of gay and bisexual men were spared from unwarranted arrests and convictions, and they did not have their jobs, professional licenses, or home lives threatened with destructions, as had occurred in the past. From 1975 to 1980, I broadened my advocacy focus to include the executive branch of government. Sexual orientation discrimination in employment, housing, and business transactions was a problem that needed to be addressed. I convinced Governor Jerry Brown in 1979 to issue an executive order prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination against state employees. This was just the second such order in the nation. Pennsylvania was the first. I also pressured the Fair Employment and Housing Department in California to interpret existing law to prohibit landlords from discriminating on the basis of sexual orientation and housing. Only one other state, Wisconsin, had such protection at the time. Throughout the 1980s, I focused my advocacy on broadening the definition of family to include a wide variety of relationships, including unmarried heterosexual couples and same-sex couples with or without children. I worked with the California legislature on this, as well as the Los Angeles City Council. I also taught the first law school class in the nation on rights of domestic partners. We convinced the city of Los Angeles to offer domestic partner benefits to city employees. Other cities started domestic partner registries where unmarried couples could register their relationships and be acknowledged as a family unit. After several years, there were many cities and many states offering legal recognition to diverse family relationships. Time for a quick pause here. A little bit of water. I met the love of my life, Michael Andrew Vasquez, in 1980. At that time, no nation on the planet recognized same-sex marriage as being legal. When we decided to marry in October 1981, we struggled to choose a venue for the ceremony. Then it came to me, remove ourselves from the jurisdiction of all nations and exercise our basic human right to marry the person we love. So we chartered a boat and took more than 200 people out to sea. We exchanged vows in international waters. As many other LGBT advocates were pressing for the legalization of same-sex marriage in the 1980s, I deliberately chose to push for an alternate method for legal recognition, expanding the definition of family in public policies and in private benefits programs, and to adopt domestic partner registries and benefits plans. I knew that the legalization of same-sex marriage was decades away. So rather than taking an all or nothing approach, I decided to gain rights and benefits piece by piece, an approach which helped millions of people while we waited for society to warm up to same-sex marriage. But just as I was advocating for equal rights for unmarried couples and families, I broadened my focus even more to fight marital status discrimination against single people. Whether they were divorced or widowed or never married, whether they lived alone or with a partner or had children. I was the founding executive director of the American Association for Single People, later known as Unmarried America. We got the media on board the singles rights movement. We walked the halls of Congress pressing for singles rights. We got governors and mayors to declare the third week of September as Unmarried and Single Americans Week. We got Unmarried America on the cover of Business Week magazine. We put singles rights on the map. Much of the discrimination against unmarried couples was rooted in religion. So when a case arose where a so-called Christian landlady refused to rent to an unmarried heterosexual couple, I jumped on the case. She was violating California law that prohibited marital status discrimination in housing. I represented the couple in court, arguing that anyone renting out an apartment or house for profit should not be allowed to violate the law in the name of religion. The California Supreme Court agreed and declared that religious beliefs did not create an exemption from the state's non-discrimination law. All businesses must obey the law, even if they are owned by people of faith. For nearly 20 years, I pushed for equal rights for employee benefits. Compensation on the job should not depend on one's marital status or living arrangement. Equal pay for equal work should be a workplace principle that applies to benefits as well as salary or hourly wages. Benefits programs around the nation, public as well as private businesses, started to adopt domestic partner benefits programs. Some of them, however, wanted to save money by only giving such benefits to unmarried same-sex couples on the ground that they could not marry. These employers wanted to force heterosexual couples to marry in order to get equal benefits, even though many of such couples, for political, religious, or philosophical reasons, did not want to marry. I refused to jump on the same-sex-only benefits bandwagon and continued to press for inclusive and gender-neutral domestic partnership benefits programs. Throughout all of my years of advocacy, I always included people with disabilities in my civil rights coalition. Some of them were harmed by antiquated sex laws that only allowed missionary-style sexual intercourse and made oral sex illegal. For example, some people with spinal cord injuries could only engage in oral sex and therefore they were forced to engage in felonious conduct. People with disabilities were too often victims of hate crimes due to perceived vulnerability or bias. So I insisted they be included in hate crime legislation and enforcement programs. Some people with disabilities could not marry because if they did, their government benefits would be eliminated or reduced. So they needed the protection of domestic partnership registries and benefits programs too. People with disabilities had special needs in their family relationships. So these needs were addressed in the family diversity work that I did. A future podcast episode will recall several years of advocacy that I did, along with my sister, my husband, Michael, and a small group of dedicated volunteers to stop the abduction and non-judicial incarceration of abused teenagers. That story will have to wait for another day. So stay tuned for a future podcast on that. So many of the cases and projects that I did from 1972 to 2009 were groundbreaking. Each of these dominoes, when they fell, created a ripple effect throughout the nation. Sexual privacy laws, executive orders by governors, court decisions affirming protections for LGBT workers and tenants, domestic partner benefits programs, and on and on. The dominoes fell and civil rights were expanded. So I hope this provides you with a better understanding of my life as an advocate for justice and equal rights for stigmatized individuals and disadvantaged populations. This life of advocacy will inform the way in which I produce future episodes of the Freedom Files and how I host each show. An upcoming show will shift focus on how I became involved in conservatorship and guardianship reform. It's been a fascinating and challenging journey for the past 9 years. I'll tell you about that soon. So with that, I will say goodbye until next time. Thank you for listening and or watching this edition of the Freedom Files. I hope you will join us again and send us ideas and suggestions for future episodes as well. You can find us online at pursuitofjusticepodcast.com. Thanks again, and until next time, I'm Tom Coleman. Goodbye. That concludes today's episode of The Freedom Files, a Pursuit of Justice podcast. For more information, visit the show's website at pursuitofjusticepodcast.com. The Freedom Files is produced and hosted by attorney Thomas F. Coleman. Assistant producers are Emmy Deckard and Trinity Pierce. Recording and post-production editing is done by Amaya Griskowitz. Artistic and technical advice from filmmaker Adam Sauch, with podcast promotional assistance from Diane Coleman Rogers. The podcast is a collaboration of Spectrum Institute and the Law Office of Thomas F. Coleman.